This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is David Batker, Chief Economist and Executive Director of Earth Economics, a nonprofit that helps identify, value, map, and model ecosystem services. David is also a co-founder of MyoNet, a private company developing next-generation data centers for the integration of health, education, and sustainability. David Batker is here today to tell us about the book he co-authored with John DeGraff, titled, What's the Economy For Anyway? Why It's Time to Stop Chasing Growth and Start Pursuing Happiness. Welcome, David.
Thank you, Diane.
What led you and John DeGraff to write your book, What's the Economy For Anyway?
Well, you know, we need to know what an economy is actually for, what it's supposed to do for us. And what we've developed since the 1930s was a vision that we needed more stuff. We needed more indoor plumbing. We needed more roads. And if you think about the 1930s, we did need those things. We had dirt tracks in this nation. Well, now we're in a different nation. The globe is different. We've got different problems, different scarcities. We've got climate change, all these issues. So now it's time we feel, before we start just saying we want to rebuild the economy of 2007, what do we actually want out of the economy?
What do you think the economy should be for?
Great question. When we were writing this book, we looked back at what Gifford Pinchot, the first head of the Forest Service, said. He said it should be for the greatest number, for the greatest good, over the longest run. And those three issues, sustainability, fairness, and prosperity, really, we feel that we need to come back to those ideals and think about that. They're very deeply rooted in America and in our history.
Why do you think we should stop chasing growth?
Well, growth is no longer providing greater happiness for our population, and that's very clear. Interviews about happiness in our population show that people would like to have more time with their families. They want more leisure time. They don't want to work 60 hours a week. And yet what we're being driven toward by trying to consume more is to say, you need to work more. You need to buy more. You need to have a bigger debt. You need to have more stress. These things are not bringing prosperity to America anymore. And so we feel that we should shift our focus from accumulation of more built capital and stuff to actually looking at what makes people better off and happier.
Well, we use GDP, or gross domestic product, as an indicator of our economic health. How did this come about, and what are its limitations as an indicator of economic health?
Great question. You know, every good measure is really the reflection of a goal. And before 1930, we had no GDP. We had no measure of inflation, no measure of unemployment, no measure of the money supply. And in fact, we had an economic crisis that unless we got a grip on what the economy was doing and producing more things, we couldn't better people's lives. So GDP was created to measure how much stuff our nation produces. Now, over the years, it has become an obsolete measure. Today, if we have more oil spills, if you have more car accidents, more divorces, more health problems, more cancer, more obesity, the GDP goes up. It's no longer an indicator of things that we actually want. It mixes goods and bads. It's like if you had a business and you added your revenue to all your costs, that would be a big number, but it would be rather meaningless because you want to know what are actually producing benefits and what's producing costs. The GDP mixes it up. So it was useful for us during a very important period of our history. It is no longer a good guide. And everyone from Nobel Prize laureates like Joe Stiglitz to conservative presidents of countries like Sarkozy in France have said the GDP's really kind of got to go.
Would you now speak about the gross national happiness indicator as an alternative to the GDP?
I had the opportunity to go to Bhutan as we were writing this book. Bhutan is a tiny country in the Himalayas, but squeezed between India and China. And when they had a king, by the way, the king phased out and said, we're going to have democracy, and he resigned, and they created a parliament. But he said, why would we chase GDP? We should have gross national happiness. And so they embarked on this wild experiment. They have nine realms, and it is a robust and far more complicated and, I think, impressive measure than GDP. They look at sustainability. They look at healthcare, they look at security, they look at schools. It's actually what people say makes them better off. And so they do a national survey. It's really an impressive measure. And we think that that is a better direction for America to go in.
Using happiness as the indicator, what do the countries that are rated happiest have in common?
Well, surprisingly, they have robust government sectors. They pay higher taxes. So you can see very clearly that Scandinavian countries do rank the highest in happiness. The U.S. is not the lowest, but countries, Switzerland and others, rank higher than the U.S. as well. And what's interesting is, what we've found is there are four areas that really contribute to an economy. And so we need new measures. There's built capital. Yes, our stuff. We do need that. Roads and cars and such. But there's also social capital. How we get along with our neighbors, our laws, and our communities. That's been degraded in the U.S. There's also human capital. How about our skills, our own individual health? Again, we're looking at a period where we may have lower lifespans and unhealthier periods of life in the United States than we've had in the past. So we need to focus on that. And finally, natural capital. So those four areas are really what kind of put together an economy and greater happiness. And we want to look at those areas more carefully than our economy currently does.
In what ways does our current economic system in the U.S. detract from personal health?
Well, we subsidize corn sugar and fat. So the cheapest food is the most unhealthy food. It's like saying what we should do is promote smoking among the population. And what would happen is we'd have a lot more cancer, you know, and this is what we have caused. We have said as a set of policies, we are going to promote unhealthy food for people. We're going to make that the most cheap food out there. For a dollar production of corn, really, it's 45 cents in return. There's about 55 cents of subsidy on corn production. And really, we produce a lot of corn for hogs to eat and the same with corn sugar and such. And so these things go into all the fast food products and high saturated fats, etc. So we have really built an agricultural system which is unhealthy for us. In fact, we feel we should tax foods that are unhealthy, tax sugar. Let's reduce the cost of healthy food, like organic food, things that make people better off. And then we'll find we really do believe in economic incentives. If food that's bad for you costs more, people will eat less of it. If food that's good for you costs less, people will eat more of it.
Would you comment on the observation that health improves during a recession?
Yes, we found this was a very curious result. During recessions, U.S. lifespan rises. People are actually healthy. Why? Because they have more time. They evidently get out and exercise more. Now, the suicide rate also goes up, which is bad. But overall health in the country increases because people have more free time. And this reflects, again, this is why our book, it's kind of humorous, it's fun. And we also look at how these things are really interconnected. So if one of our objectives is people need to work 65 hours a week, you need to work more, you need to buy more, you need to have more debt. So we have one group of people working more, being more unhealthy because you have to have time to be more healthy. And then another group of people completely unemployed. And then we all know that we need more time with our family. So, you know, having this one group of people work 65 hours a week and others work not at all is not a way to make our economy healthy or our population healthy.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is David Batker, co-author with John DeGraff of the book What's the Economy For, Anyway? Why It's Time to Stop Chasing Growth and Start Pursuing Happiness. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. How does our current economic environment contribute to making individuals feel insecure?
Well, in fact, when I grew up in Tacoma, we didn't lock our door. We never locked our door. And in fact, if I went over to my friend's house as a kid, I could go in and have a sandwich and use their phone. It seems kind of crazy, but we had real community there. And I think, you know, you look at the policies in the U.S., our decision has been we're going to throw lots of people in jail. Prison is our solution. And it's cheaper to send them to college. It actually is cheaper to send people to college. Whereas other countries have very different policies, which are more successful. You look at the murder rate, the U.S. is way beyond any other country. It's been declining, which is good, but we're still way out there. In France, They take kids from the city who are really having trouble or who have gotten trouble with the law. Instead of throwing them in Raymond Hall in Tacoma or a detention center pretty much, they put them in a rural town. They send them to school there. Their identity is known because there are only 400 or so people in the town. And they've found that they have less recidivism, etc., that they do better. So one of the core points of this book is that we can learn from other countries. We can learn why they have greater safety, why the U.S. is slipping in so many rankings. You know, we're 42nd when it comes to infant mortality. That is just outrageous. We're the wealthiest nation in the world. Why should our infants die more than other wealthy countries? So these things are not mysterious. The solutions are evident and have been practiced in other countries.
Would you comment on economic inequality in the U.S. and the drawbacks for society as a whole?
It's very clear that economic inequality hurts economies and damages the level of happiness within a country as that inequality stretches out. Now, we don't say everybody ought to have the equal amount of everything. Of course, we need some amount of inequality. But if you look at a country like Denmark, people are very happy. And when you interview people in Denmark, it's very interesting. A very common answer will be, one of our goals is greater equality. We want all people within our country to have a good education, good health care, and good opportunity. And the U.S., you know, at one time, the U.S. had the most vacation in the world, the shortest working hours of any nation in the world. We had the highest pay, the highest productivity. We had all these elements that built our middle class, and the wealth distribution after 1920 was squeezed down. We had a huge middle class rise. We had a reduction in the disparity of income. It was our greatest period of economic success and where we led the world. And then as we're stretched out, as we have an increasing number of people on the bottom, and you know, from homelessness to families just barely scraping by, a quarter of our children are in poverty. This is crazy for a nation of our wealth. Those children must be brought out of poverty. And until we deal with inequality in America, we will, I think, have a declining economy.
Would you comment on how economic inequality affects the capacity or capabilities of the next generation?
Absolutely. As I mentioned, one quarter of our children are in poverty. This is terrible. They don't have equal education. The 2008 financial crisis was a good example. Right here in the Puget Sound region, children were thrown out of their homes and we're still having foreclosures. When a child is thrown out of their home, when their parents don't have a job, they don't have opportunity to continue, then of course they're not going to do well in school. And there's just across the board a tremendous amount of research showing that for health, education, personal skills, all these areas, as inequality expands, the whole population suffers. And then, of course, you have greater crime. One of the most important parts of this book, and I think economics is suffering because we don't look at the systematic connections between the things like inequality, poverty, crime, health, time-work balance, sustainability in the environment. This book pulls it all together.
How have policies over the past 30 years contributed to unequal wealth distribution?
Great question. I was once a Republican precinct committeeman, and I am ashamed of where the Republican Party has gone in this country. Because if you look at conservatives, for instance, in Europe, Sarkozy, Cameron, etc., they believe that we should not have a wildly disparate wealth distribution. They also believe in science. And yet we have many so-called conservatives, I don't think they're conservatives, who have a medieval view of science. And they have an 1890s view of economics, as if we need to annihilate benefits, that social benefits are bad, healthcare, etc. This is crazy. And it stems from an ideology rather than actual economics. Even Alan Greenspan came out and said basically that the economic studies show really wide distribution of wealth is damaging for an economy. And economic analysis and a whole series of academic studies show that in those cases, it's better to put higher taxes on the wealthy. Here was somebody who's, I would say he's a conservative, but he's at least rational enough to pay attention to what we know about how economies work and wealth distribution.
As you point out in your book, one challenge brought about by current economic activity is environmental degradation. What are the most important changes in economic policy to protect ecosystems for the future?
Great question again. We have two huge problems. One set of problems are environmental, and those deal with, I would say, stocks and flows that are physically measurable. We're pumping too much CO2 into the atmosphere and we're getting warming of the climate. Too many toxics, loss of forest cover, which results in greater flooding and damage. These are all things that have to do with physical stocks and flows. And yet we don't make decisions based on physical stocks and flows. We make decisions based on financial stocks and flows, government budgets, rates of return for companies, benefit cost analysis. So I think, and this is kind of a radical position from the environmental stance, that our real focus needs to be on correcting a lot of incorrect economic signals. So one area is to change benefit cost analysis. Right now, the Army Corps of Engineers cannot include the benefits of natural systems for flood protection. So we just look at levees and dams as providing flood protection, when actually farms, forests, wetlands all provide a huge amount of flood protection. The most shocking example is the loss of 1.2 million acres in the delta of the Mississippi River, and those communities are not sustainable. You will have a retreating economy. So policies that include environmental benefits and economic analysis for companies, for the nation, benefit cost analysis, for our national measures must be included if we're going to really fix the whole suite of environmental problems that we have.
Would you like to touch on the tools that you have developed for cost-benefit analysis of ecosystem services?
Yes, thank you. So for example, ecosystem services are the benefits that nature provides to people, from flood protection to drinking water, recreation, aesthetic value, erosion protection. There are 23 big categories. This is worth a lot of money. And Seattle has a great case, and this is also points out why we have to change our economics to improve things. Seattle in 1898 was declared by the New York Times one of the most unhealthy cities in the U.S. We had cholera, typhoid. People died. A lot of people died in Seattle. The whole downtown burned down, 65 acres, because they didn't have water. So finally the people said, why do we have these four utility private companies which take water out of Lake Washington, where waste also flows? We need to have a public utility. They purchased the Cedar River watershed. Incredible. What a buy, because we've never had to have a filtration plant. That would cost us $200 million today to build a filtration plant. We've had that service for free. So at least that filtration value is worth $200 million. We're starting to measure the value of those ecosystem services. And until we understand that, we are going to have a declining economy. In the Midwest, Earth Economics, we showed that across millions of acres, as farmers tiled those acres, in other words, put pipes in to drain the land, well, that drained trillions of gallons of water into the Mississippi River. So even though we'd invested more than $10 billion in bigger levees in the Mississippi, we had the biggest flood in history. And it wasn't from water coming down, as traditional floods were, and flooding communities below. It was because the water flowed very quickly into the Mississippi and couldn't get down the Mississippi, and so it backed up into cities like Cedar Rapids and other cities. So we had one infrastructure we built, tiling, which destroyed another infrastructure, the levees and our most valuable cities. So understanding the flood protection value of agriculture and these other areas is crucial to flood protection everywhere in the United States and elsewhere. There are a lot of other aspects about ecosystem services as well.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is David Batker, co-author with John DeGraff of the book, What's the Economy For, Anyway? Why It's Time to Stop Chasing Growth and Start Pursuing Happiness. In your book, you speak about the health of the U.S. economy and society in the 1950s and 60s. Why was the U.S. successful during this time period?
Our focus was to build a middle class. And in fact, the focus was how do you raise wages, real wages? So we had a high tax rate on the wealthy. In fact, President Eisenhower had a 94% tax on Americans earning more than $1 million. He decided we're going to pay off the debt of World War II, the biggest debt in U.S. history. We're still going to build freeways and increase infrastructure in this nation. And by taxing the wealthiest, as well as everyone else paying higher taxes, we built a strong economy. We also had a set of policies, for instance, Social Security. We're building a greater social infrastructure in the U.S. So those are parts of our success during that time period. And then we had a throwback. Well, let me explain. When I said there's a difference between conservatism and what I would say is laissez-faire economics, in other words, just blow off all the rules and go for it, 1890s style economics. And that sort of came back in the 1980s with Ronald Reagan. And this view in the U.S., which is not held by conservatives elsewhere in the world, that we just need to eliminate regulations, is a crazy set of rules. One example is that a policy of seller be honest is always better than a policy of buyer beware. Let me explain that. A buyer beware, we had that when we had patent medicines in the late 1800s. And you could buy a medicine that claimed everything. Like there was one medicine which said it would eliminate all pain, didn't make any difference, broken arm, arthritis, toothache, you know, whatever it is, because it had a neurotoxin in it. And you'd take a slug of that stuff, jitter around on the floor because it was impacting your nervous system, and yeah, it killed the pain. So it didn't matter what pain it was. Some people were paralyzed afterwards. So we decided we're going to regulate medicine, and we are going to say, if you're going to sell a medicine, it needs to do what you say it does. And that way, it's seller be honest, and regulations are required for that. And it doesn't matter whether you're building a house, whether you're producing gasoline or anything else. We had a huge wave during the 60s and 50s which said, we're going to have sellers be honest. And that policy paid off big time because we didn't have melanin in our milk like China. We had milk that you can trust is going to be safe to drink. And now this wave of let's get rid of regulations, I think is very dangerous for the U.S. because what it has shown is that it makes our industries, in fact, less efficient, less competitive. So if you look at a country like Germany, the most successful industrial country right now, they have stronger regulations, and that's the direction they're moving in, even with a conservative leader.
Well, you've alluded to this throughout the interview, but how can we change our economic policy in the U.S. to help enhance happiness and well-being?
Well, we feel that we have all the energy and knowledge to do it. If you look at the greatest periods of progress in the U.S., like take 1900 to 1920, it's amazing. We had four constitutional amendments during that period. We reorganized the Senate. It was never elected, the Senate. It was sort of appointed. So we got a constitutional amendment there. We got the income tax, which was crucial because farmers were paying a lot of property tax and the bankers paid nothing. So we got the income tax. We got the vote for women. Expanding rights always gives greater strength to the economy. And of course, the prohibition, which was repealed later. So we also, during that time, we had 1,500 constitutional amendments to state constitutions. Oregon had 50. Washington had close to 50. And we got the recall, the initiative process, the referendum process, primaries, all these things really changed our nation. But why did that happen? Because men who wanted clean government said, we need more clean government voters too. We're going to join with the suffragettes. And so we had this melting of progressive silos, and people got together and said, we are going to have a wholesale change, and we're going to improve things. We're going to get rid of corruption. Right now, of course, again, we're at historic levels of corruption with what's happening on Wall Street, et cetera. And so it's time, I think, that we took this more holistic view, and that is how we're going to get progress. And the book points this out. We need to have a constitutional amendment to ban corporate personhood and campaign contributions. That is contaminating and destroying our democracy. And the only way we're going to get there is when health activists and environmental activists and everybody else gets together. And I think that is the way we're going to get a wholesale sweeping change for a 21st century economy, not stepping back into the 1800s.
Would you say more about specific steps that could be taken?
Oh, sure. So there are a lot of things. We look around the world and look at policies which work. For example, in the Netherlands, there's a law they have which allows for work sharing. And so a person can have part-time work. It allows for greater flexibility for employers. So you don't have to employ someone full-time or part-time with no benefits. It's got kind of a sliding scale there. And that's good for employees because if some have children, they want to stay home when their kids are born, et cetera, then they can do that. They have greater flexibility for hours, and it gives companies greater flexibility. Two, the U.S. is only one of four countries in the entire world that does not mandate maternal leave. That is outrageous. So in Canada, you get 1 year off when your kid is born. And studies, it's all over for the debate. It's clear. When infants are home with their moms or their dads, they do better in school, they have better health care, they have less crime, etc. It goes on and on. Only Lesotho, Liberia, Papua New Guinea, and the United States do not require time at home with a newborn baby. And the U.S. has to adopt that approach. Also, vacation. We led the world once in vacation. Studies, it doesn't matter whether it's the Harvard Business School or in China, show that if you have more vacation, you're actually more productive. And in the U.S., more than 40% of our population doesn't even take vacation. The normal company offers perhaps 2 weeks of paid vacation, and no paid vacation is actually required by law. We need to have at least 3 weeks paid vacation required. That gives us a healthier society. It actually improves productivity. So these are just a few. That's one of the nice reviews about the book. It says every chapter has solutions in it. And we feel that the solutions are spread on the table before us as puzzle pieces. We need to put them together and really improve our economy for the 21st century.
What type of economy do we need in the 21st century? Would you like to summarize?
Yes. The 20th century was about one problem, one infrastructure. You know, stormwater, build a stormwater system. Flooding, build levees. Telephones, build telephone wires. Healthcare, just build health clinics. The 21st century is about a systems approach. It's about an integrated approach where we know that we want to grow food that's healthy. Our subsidies should promote that. They should not promote unhealthy food. That time at home with infants reduces crime, etc. These things are completely integrated. And so the infrastructure is more integrated. Part of the 20th century boon was rural electrification. What's a new vision for rural communities that brings them to greater economic prosperity? We feel like it's optic fiber, data centers, greater information in those rural areas, greater capacity to manage rural resources, also payment for ecosystem services. Those rural areas actually do provide flood control for urban areas, but there's no payment from urban areas receiving flood benefits to rural areas. So what happens is those flood protection value in rural areas is degraded. We end up building costly levees. Those costly levees get demolished by bigger floods and cities are damaged. We lose some of our most important manufacturing areas. So by looking at natural systems as part of our entire infrastructure, we get better benefits overall for things like flood control and recreation, aesthetic value, and property values. So the 21st century is about integrated infrastructure and really looking at these problems in a more systemic and systems approach.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I think the economy is not doom and gloom. We have a century ahead of us where we can have happier, better lives. It undoubtedly means consuming less, less debt. It's a different vision than the 20th century, that a growth-led economy is not bringing us to greater happiness, but an economy which actually values the greatest good for the greatest number over the longest run can bring us to a better, happier, and more fulfilling and prosperous economy.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Dave.
Thank you very much, Diane.
You have just been listening to David Batker, Executive Director of Earth Economics and co-author with John DeGraff of the book, What's the Economy For, Anyway? Why It's Time to Stop Chasing Growth and Start Pursuing Happiness, published in 2011 by Bloomsbury Press. For more information, check on the web at www.eartheconomics.org. Again, that's eartheconomics.org. The Sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the Streaming Archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, Sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters Sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP. dot org.